anybody want to take a break for coffee and stuff?
I'm good.
Okay.
What's your website again?
This particulars. Let me write down the URI to this presentation.
Just be really careful with the power cord. If we unplug it, I have no battery life. It'll just be like...
In like the biological sciences, do you think cybernetic theories are getting like a greater hold among academics, or do you think it's still pretty fringe? Because to me it seems like it's still kind of fringe.
You know, it's funny that it should be fringe at all, because it's, some people are like, cybernetics, that's so outdated. You know, like that was you know, engineering stuff we were doing back in the 50s. But in the 70s, because of people like Makran and Fidella, they really generated in the biological computer lab, you know, they generated a lot of interest in the biology related to this stuff. Most of the biologists that I interact with are cyberneticians, at least partially. I don't interact with a whole lot of biologists now, but the biologists that I have met, most of them don't. Really, like, I know, like, biologists are awesome biologists, and they've never heard of them very long. And, you know, it's just very personal knowledge, I guess. But, yeah, I think it's still pretty fringy. There's a lot of question, even within the cybernetics community, about the applicability of these ideas. You know, a lot of people are.
Well, it seems like, you know, like the idea of cybernetics can get reappropriated by different groups and used for different means.
Well, it does, and in a way, I mean, in a lot of ways, everything that we do with computers and network technology and stuff today evolved from cybernetics. Cybernetics per se, you know, isn't really, no one is even with. Has not been terribly successful. Well, here's the thing. I'll give you my take on this. And it comes back to von Forrester's distinction between trivial and non-trivial machines. The thing about trivial machines is they always produce results. So if you're a businessman and you're in charge of funding a research group, you want to fund a research group that produces results. And so the artificial intelligence community has been able to produce, and the robotics communities have been able to produce a number of mechanisms that do cool shit, but they're not really autonomous. Nobody's really created artificial life. There's a lot of really cool mechanisms, machines out there, and ideas, but I think von Forrester said, you know, these are really cool ideas that are coming out. They say more, really, about the ingenuity of the people that are designing them than they say about any kind of universal laws of intelligence or anything like that. You know, there's a lot of contention about, you know, like I said, you know, how applicable are these ideas. Like, if non-trivial machines are really the way things are, why don't we have a bunch of cool, smart, non-trivial machines running around, watching our TV and eating our food? And then some people would reply, we do. It's us.
I wonder what your viewpoint on connecting these ideas to the idea of cybernetic enhancements on people.
Well, I think that, well, I have a couple of thoughts. That's how I originally got into cybernetics, was that sort of thing, that sort of idea. And I think it's great. I think anything that we can do, I mean, obviously I am, or I sympathize with transhumanists, so I wouldn't come to these meetings, so I don't come here to argue. So, I support the notion that, that we can use technology to make our lives better. For me, cybernetics offers is a framework for how and why technology makes our lives better. You know, a framework for understanding, hey, you know, this technology makes my life better because, it's attenuating a variety in my environment, which might, be destructive to me otherwise, or whatever. Some ethical notions of responsibility in constructivist philosophy, as far as taking ownership for what I bring to that, to whatever technology I use.
Laptop doesn't help. Anybody?
Actually, I have a question. So your last slide, if I'm quoting it correctly, I think it said something about there being an ethical imperative to increase variety. Could you expound a little bit more on that?
Right. To increase, Heinz said, to increase the number of choices. So the idea there being that that what empowers us is choice, and anything that we can do to give us more choices in this situation is a good thing. Now, I've thought about that a little bit. I think and actually going back to the discussion that we had last time, I think there are definitely situations in which too much choice can be a problem. For example, when we were talking about good website development, to some degree, you want to lead your audience to whatever it is you're trying to sell them or communicate to them or whatever. If you give me a remote control that does everything, the first thing I'm going to do is go, what do I do with this? I can do anything with it, right? But on the other hand, when you think about why is it, why do we have 10 million news feeds out there? Because we want to know more. We want to be informed so that we can make better decisions. So that we can, so that we can not be told what to do, and we can make our own informed choices about it. At least that's my take on it. That's kind of how I see it.
There was Douglas Hofstadter taught at Indiana University when I went to school, and he actually taught English classes on occasion, and just in the idea of having constraints and working within those boundaries, and I know you talked a little bit on that earlier, but we're best at being creative. His idea in the classes that he taught was you have to stick to this rhyming pattern if we're writing poetry, and it has to rhyme correctly, and you can't write free verse. You have to stick in within this pattern, because that's when you have your most creative moments. It's when you're forced into a box and you figure out how to work within that.
Well, I say a similar thing about, I mentioned Vernacular Crime earlier, Epoch. I don't know if you all know what that is. It is technically, I guess, maybe a constraint on the language Alfred presents the book General Semantics. And he didn't develop E Prime. Forget the name of the guy. It's based off of General Semantics. But the gist of it is, you drop every version of the word to be from your writing and speaking of English.
Okay.
And so what that constraint causes you to do is, like, I can't say you're a nice guy. Because whatever you may be, it's not encapsulated by a nice guy. I have to say, I have to take ownership of that observation and find another way to word it. That is, still using verbs, but I can't just say you are this or I am that. I have to say, I perceive you as a nice guy, or you do things that I perceive as very nice, or something like that. It can be really cumbersome when you first do it. I don't know if any of you know who Robert Anton Wilson is. Robert Anton Wilson actually writes most or all of his books in E Prime, and you'd never know because he's a fluid writer. But he is a huge proponent of it, and as well as neurolinguistic programming, which developed out of some of which was influenced by some of the teachings that he has. Anywho. So the same kind of thing that, like, you're taking something away there, but in doing that, you're pushing the person operating within those constraints to find other avenues of expression, to explore other areas of the search space they normally wouldn't, because they would usually take an easy road. Same with tasks and music coloration, right? If I keep playing the same notes over and over and over, the machine stops responding to me. If I wanted to get the machine to respond, I have to start playing original pieces of music.
The way that I would initially think of this is you have all the choices that you could make, and you want there to be as many as possible, but if decreasing the number of choices you have here increases the complexity at some later level, you want to increase the net choice of some of them.
That's a good way to say it.
The idea of having a lot of choices available to you reminds me of a social theorist. I forget who it was. I can look it up. But the idea was we're highly individuated in cities because we have so many choices. We get to decide exactly what we want to do. There's somebody else who's going to cover your food. You don't have to worry about that. I can play on the computer all day and talk to my friends and do what I want to do. But in smaller communities, you're forced to fulfill so many roles that you're more connected. It's a healthier community in general, but because you're not able to have one path of choices, like, okay, now I'm going to choose this and then this and then this, you have to choose them all. I need a diagram and a piece of paper. But instead of having to choose five things that are one step out from you, in a small community, you can choose five individual steps on a path to become more individuated. I don't know how that relates to cybernetics, but it made me think of it.
Yeah, and well, you talk about the power of selection and then, the array of choices that are available to any person or any organism. It's just interesting to think that after a certain point in time, though, choices do have to be made.
I mean, I think, in terms of requisite variety, mm-hmm. I hate saying that humans are more evolved than animals. It's really a fallacy. Every animal evolves to its niche. But there is a sense in which we definitely have a much greater variety of things we can do than animals in general. Now, again, you know, going back to the rock versus the cat, there's things that a rock can do that the cat just can't. You can't build a pyramid out of a cat. So
my plans are ruined.
I don't know, maybe you can vote fast to help you out. Nothing has all of the variety except, you know, possibly a deity. You know, and you get notions there of omnifariousness and omnipresence and omniscience and omnipotence. Everything is structurally determined, where we have the advantage, where we have a huge advantage is in language. In the fact that we recognize that, we can model that, we can change the models, we can test them out, and we can see which ones fit. The constructivist emphasis there is just that, is just on that interaction. Don't take it for granted. Everything that I know about my environment, I know because my eyes are capable of seeing green. Because my particular nose is capable of smelling the various coffee grounds. Who knows what other information is out there? And we can develop instruments to amplify and attenuate that and reach out in different ways. But and that's really what humans have done. You know, we can see from the idea, well, maybe there is something else going on. So let's build a machine that can help us figure that out. But again, that machine structure is going to determine what it's able to interact with. And then it's, again, coupled to us, and we're coupled to each other, etc. But,
Matt and I were discussing in the chat about how if it's not a part of your language, you can't really comprehend it. Language being what's in your, what you've interacted with before, and the idea that the first natives, with the hyperactive bunny ears, to see Columbus's ships were, in theory, not even able to see them as what they were because it wasn't there.
Like, yeah. Now,
I don't know about that, but as an
that kind
idea.
Of goes back to the warp sphere hypothesis, yes. And probably, you know, Rita can tell you way more about that stuff.
Oh dear.
But one of the things I liked about Pinker's book, Steven Pinker's book, which I quoted once in the presentation, although he's not a psychometrician, a lot of his ideas are not very psychometric at all, but one of the things I did like about his book is that he says, well, you know, if it was really like that, if we were completely constrained by our language, we wouldn't learn anything. There's got to be some facility by which you're developing new information. But on the other hand, we definitely filter out a lot. Psychologists have had, there have been many tests that show all the stuff that we filter out. Von Forrester is a big fan of the black star and the black circle, and you hold the paper close enough to your face and the circle disappears from view.
Yeah.
A lot of people, that's like a whoa moment for them. Like, wow, where'd the circle go? You know, I thought it was there, but I can't see it. And, so there again, there's that notion of reality developing interactionally. There is kind of a notion in cybernetics that, for example, if you go into a library, most people think of libraries as being full of information. But if you go into a library and you can't read, there is no information for you. If I turn the lights on, somebody blind in that is in the room, that doesn't mean anything to them. Like, they didn't receive any information from my action.
Yeah.
So that brings me to a point about informatics theory, which is one of the main sort of paradigms that emerged from that was the idea that information as property is sort of independent of the medium in which it's embodied. So it's kind of just something that's out there and it can lie and remain unchanged depending. second order is in our genes or in a computer, there's no difference. So I wonder how that lines up with what you're saying, which I totally agree with, which is that information has to sort of be perceived or be able to be interpreted to exist.
It's a good question. And it's frankly, off the bat, it's one I don't have a solid answer to. It's something I think a lot about. Kind of related to that, something that often is associated with cybernetics, and I think is played down by people who are really into second-order cybernetics and constructivism, is the idea that, some of the early cybernetics works was in stuff like pacemakers, right? And this notion that it doesn't have to be a heart, it just has to do what a heart does. So you can take that function and you can put it into all kinds of different media and still, you know, still create those connections. And I think that correlates a lot with transhumanist values as far as, the idea that technology isn't inherently evil or anything, and it's what we do with it. And thought train derailed.
Divorcing the essence of what is us from the stuff that makes us.
Yeah, there is some of that. But on the other hand, there's all the form equals function that you find in cybernetics, the structural determinants and stuff like that. I'm really not, I'm okay with having both ideas in mind at the same time. I'm really not sure that I'm personally comfortable with the divide on that. But it's a great, it's definitely something to consider.
So if you have both, you just have analogous forms, right? If the form creates the function, but you also believe that it doesn't matter what the form is so much, then all you're talking about is having forms that create analogous functions, like a pacemaker creating an analogous heart function to the heart.
Right. Definitely. And that might correspond well with the analogies of something like cybernetics. One of the reasons I didn't define what cybernetics was, really, is that there are a lot of different definitions of it. One of the things that Gordon Pass said is that cybernetics is the science of defensible metaphors. With his work with conversation theory and the interaction of actors, he did a lot of work with analogies like that. I'm not sure I was going with that. I think that's appropriate. That's an appropriate notion. There's some middle ground there, for example, with informatics, a bit stream can be encoded in fiber optics, electrical signals. I can put the lights on and off, I can say 10001, whatever. So there's various media that bit stream can travel in. At the same time, at some level, it requires a distinction, it requires a difference, it requires a digitization, it requires some kind of recognition between this state and that state, and then correlating that series of distinctions and computing that series of distinctions as whatever the message is. And again, the message can be different. I can feed a bit stream to a dog. Dog doesn't care. But if I feed it to the appropriate device, the device that is built to interpret it to something, then I have something cool happens then.